All right, well.
Now, there's no specific case on this, so, I mean, on this one, I don't necessarily think we have to broadcast it. We just record it.
Okay.
And we also don't have to sit up here. We could sit down there unless we just want to stay where we're at. We might as well.
Well, from a distancing standpoint.
Yeah, it's probably good.
So, is that occurring, Matt, that we're just recording at this point in time, or are we?
We're recording, don't we? Oh, wait.
Yeah, we don't.
Okay, I thought so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't have to broadcast this.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's all yours.
All right.
Well, I suppose we could quick open it up officially since it's a recorded. Good morning, everyone. It is Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020, 11:40 a.m. This is a discussion with Mr. John Wieda, Transmission Authority, North Dakota Transmission Authority, and the Commission. And I'm going to hand it over to Commissioner Fedorchuk, and
sure.
You can take it from there.
All right. Well, just to keep it simple, John was listening, and he's been participating quite a bit. He was the governor's rep, along with Reese from the governor's office, on the MGA effort relating to transmission build-out. And so he's been working a lot on transmission issues, as he does, because he's the head of the Transmission Authority. Also has been pretty intimately involved in all the state's efforts on the Coal Creek facility and the DC line. Not that we plan to get into that here, but John's just got a lot of involvement in these issues, and so I was really pleased that he was able to at least listen to the conversations we had with MISO and SPP yesterday, and he had some thoughts that he wanted to share or some observations or concerns or whatever, so this is a great venue for him to be able to share those. So, John, maybe we'll just pass it over to you. And I didn't actually bring my reports in, but I can run and grab them, too. And then you should hit your mic so we can grab your, yeah.
Okay.
Just keep it recording.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me because it was helpful. And I've had more opportunities to be in front of MISO than I have SPP. SPP participated in the MGA work that Julie was talking about, and I've been on the phone with them a few times and invited to Basin Electric, I guess, one time with them, but it's been less easy, so to speak, to develop a relationship with SPP, so I really appreciate it. Being able to be here yesterday, I had to leave a little early for the Industrial Commission, but I sensed that you were close to wrapping up, so I, by the time I was done down there, I didn't figure there was anything left happening up here. So, I did find it very interesting, though, and I guess I would have to say, in hindsight, this is probably true of the other times that both parties have presented. There's clearly a different culture in their presentation, and but I really appreciated, you know, it seemed like the information we got from SPP was pretty direct and more time sensitive, so to speak. It's more of we're going to do this by then as opposed to we're working on this, and so I appreciated that.
They don't seem to have as much of, like, I know they have a stakeholder process, but it doesn't feel as complicated or lengthy to me, just as an outside observer. I mean, MISO's stakeholder process is things get tangled up in there for years.
Oh,
so that's my one observation between the two.
I thought it was interesting, and I didn't want to necessarily say this in my opening comments as but I actually, it was a mixed bag for me after listening to both. I was I had concerns, to be really honest, after MISO presented, because I thought they have to know some of these things that they're just not saying. And SPP was more direct, I thought, in terms of what they provided. And they, you know, the elephant in the room is on cost allocation. Who pays for this? And how do you measure benefit to users? And at least there's a formula in place that I'm aware of with SPP. And MISO might have a formula as well.
They have to.
But they don't share it. And why wouldn't they talk about it? Because it's I thought it was vague and elusive in nature, just personally.
Yeah.
I walked out with, you know, probably more questions than things that were answered after. And I do worry that, you know, if Coal Creek is an example of what can or can't happen, you know, it's a different culture, and I think it's driven by states that aren't maybe as like-minded as North Dakota on the MISO side, but more like-minded on the SPP side. I don't know if that's a fair assessment or not, but it seemed that way, that no, SPP states that they serve are more like us. And MISO states there are more REOs in place on the MISO states, I would suspect, than the SPP sites. And that's really what states, and that seems to drive a lot of it.
Well, one of the things I found interesting, I guess I knew a little bit of this, but I didn't realize how much SPP is doing in the western states.
Yeah.
And so to me, that was kind of a signal. I mean, there's geography involved, of course, or adjacent, but there must also be a level of trust with the western states to hire SPP to do the things that they are doing.
And frankly, SPP, I think it's fair to say, would have had a very significant expansion. I mean, just like when the Dakotas and Iowa joined in, mm-hmm. I don't know, 5 years ago or whatever it was, we would have had this other Western expansion, I think, done already. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very close to a done deal a couple of years ago. And frankly, XL of Colorado pulled out of it. It's sort of unraveled things, and now this is the direction of just providing services that is being pursued.
I actually had a slightly different take on the SPP versus MISO presentation, and I felt this way with SPP a lot in the past with their meetings too. They send somebody much more general. Like the people that were on the phone, they were not subject matter experts. So I don't know what their roles are, but I feel like they're sort of the equivalent to what Allison Archer is for MISO, kind of like the intermediary to the states. And I was going to ask Victor that in the future, I'd like for them to have some of the people who can speak to more specific questions that those guys, I mean, they told me very basic answers to some of the stuff I was asking, that it's like, I know you're doing that, but I want to, you know, like the, how many days in the multi-day, they couldn't even answer how many days they have in their multi-day market, you know, so that's just a frustration that they don't, they should have more expertise in those meetings to address some of the questions, in my opinion. You know, Aubrey, is his last name Johnson? Aubrey. He's head of planning for MISO. Like, he is the expert on planning for MISO. And to be able to have him sit in for an hour with us, it's pretty valuable that he made that commitment of his time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just feel like that's something I'd like to tweak with SPP down the road.
Yeah. And I think Ben and Lee are quite knowledgeable. You certainly did catch him on one that they didn't have ready.
I was surprised that he didn't know that. I really expected.
And I don't know the answer to it either. But I think generally don't issue the grade completely on that question.
Yeah. Well, there was more than that, though. I just don't know what their roles are. But when they, you know, when we have the agenda, I'd like for them to send somebody who's, like, had or really intimately involved in the subject versus a more general person who kind of is the liaison to us, if they're able to do that. Especially when it's just on the phone. I mean, it's not that long of a... not that big of a commitment.
Maybe it's a short
call in, yeah. But what are the concerns do you have, John, just beyond the styles and stuff?
Well, I did go through the MISO slides and marked a number of things that I reacted to one degree or another. You know, first of all, when you look at the MISO queue information and look at the magnitude of the gigawatts, and then you stop and think about there isn't growth in the system. Those gigawatts are replacing gigawatts for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Huge, rapid change, if even if a percentage of that does take place. And, you know, so then you go into their, the other piece is that 69% of their interconnection requests are solar. You know, and sure, it's stronger in the south than it is up north. Solar tax credits are not based on production. They're based on investment. And so I'm worried about the impact that that has on the overall grid. And, you know, I realize there are places where solar may be a wise investment. But, you know, when we've got that much, we're talking about gigawatts of stuff in the queue, and then we're talking about 69% of the 2020 being solar. I didn't pick up the gigawatts associated with that.
What was it? It was a massive number in terms of gigawatts. Or I might have the two mixed up. Was it 4.2?
I don't recall the numbers, but I also was surprised that it's that much. But then down south, it's working better.
So yeah. With three gigawatts essentially coming off solar, 4.2 is the number. That's massive.
But no matter where you put it, it does bring up the conflict of land use, because... you know, you can put up wind without impacting a lot of land, but when you put up solar, the acres per gigawatt are very substantial. So, you know, it doesn't seem to be getting a lot of push or press at this point in time, but I'm thinking that as we roll forward, if those kinds of levels of interest continue, there's going to be land use considerations that are going to start raising their head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, MISO, I think, and maybe SPP to some extent, but MISO is, without question, in my mind, one of the driving factor in terms of future transmission needs. It starts with policy decisions on renewable energy objectives, mandates. Entities trying to capture lucrative tax incentives, whether it's production, through the production tax credit or subsidies or the investment tax credit, which actually I'm not entirely surprised on the solar side just because of the mechanism of the ITC and the flexibility that an ITC provides compared to a PTC and the transferability and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they're valuable right now. It's almost like a currency in itself, and it has value compared to the PTC. So I'm not entirely surprised on that, although it was noticeable. But it seems like on the MISO side, the state, it's starting with policy, and then everything is following policy. SPP gave me more of the impression that it was based on more on need than to accommodate development, but That could be wrong. You said on SPP.
Mm. I don't think there's need anywhere at this point, is there?
No.
All of this is to accommodate development. It feels like to me, and to accommodate the states that have the renewable portfolio standards to meet, and the companies. That's the tricky part, is the companies themselves have these objectives like Excel and that's where, I mean, that's where we get into saying, you know, yeah, this is what our position is on our resource mix.
And I want to address your land use point, because I've been very surprised in the last few years at how I used to think that was a bigger deal to people than what it appears to be as I'm here these last few years. Within the length of my lifetime, I remember when that was a huge deal, when you would hear ag producers arguing against a development. And, of course, then there were not much more than half as many people on the planet as there are now, but about the billions of people that we could be feeding.
Yeah.
We need to be cautious with the use of our land. In more recent years, it's about, you know, we've got, and I understand we have low commodity prices for most of the ag commodities. It's about, this is my land. Leave me alone. Let me do what I want with it. Energy development pays better than farming. And so just leave me alone. I want this paycheck.
Yeah.
And while the solar takes more acres per gigawatt completely out of production, a solar development will take those acres, and it's tight knit, as opposed to covering tens of thousands of acres and then having hundreds of thousands of acres of people that have to look at them and listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so while the actual out of production acreage is more dramatic with solar, I'd say the impact on people who are concerned is a lot less.
Oh, right. Yeah. You know, you can, out in this part of the world, a solar facility, if it were to go in and it was a mile off of interstate, you know, with the rolling terrain, you might not even see it.
Yep.
30 miles away, you can see the turbines.
Yeah.
You know, so the visual aspect, I think, is different. And yeah, I don't think neighbors are as opposed to them because they don't have the noise.
The other piece, and I don't know if you've seen this, and I think it's come before the commission, and I haven't studied this, but as I think about what incents solar, having a PPA is maybe not a big deal to the developer, whereas with wind, very few are willing to take the market risk. But if you're getting a return on the investment versus the production, you might as well take a risk in the market and go ahead and get it built. I think the financial driver.
Yeah.
What role will the interconnection play in solar, knowing that? Like, I hadn't really thought about the difference in the incentive.
Well,
because if they don't, what if they build them and don't even have a connection? Do they still get their investment?
No, they have to have the connection.
Okay.
But especially when most of the interconnects have been for wind, getting a solar interconnect is easier because of time of day.
Yeah.
And then also you do get a capacity, a greater capacity allocation. So if you're just selling it on mm-hmm. the capacity basis, you get a higher capacity rating. I don't remember the number for sure, but I think it's 50% or more for solar. Because of the fact that the peak production does coincide with peak demand.
Right.
Boy, talk about a messed up energy market when you think about it. Well, you don't have to think about it very hard. It's not driven by need. It's driven by subsidies, taxes, everything but, really what end users need for energy. And I think the next decade is actually going to be.
It's not going to go away soon. Yeah.
It's going to be bad from a cost standpoint.
Because I think it's something we all will probably need to talk about down the road a little bit. But as we look at MISO's, one of the things they talked about was this long-term transmission planning. So they're actively pursuing some new rounds of big projects. And we'll need a position, like a position for where we are on this. And as I listen to state leaders talk about this, and without any additional expansion of the electric grid in North Dakota, our development is going to be curtailed. And while I recognize that there are groups of folks who will cheer that, I also think that there are lots of folks who don't, from an economic development standpoint, want to see that being the reason that this industry stops growing in North Dakota. So my position is, so you guys can let me know if you see things differently, open to the transmission development, but when it comes to the paying for it, that the people who are receiving the power at the other end and those who are generating the power, especially most of them are merchant generators, are going to be, they pay a bulk of the costs for the new lines. That's where that's what I view as like my position right now and how I intend to represent sort of North Dakota's position. Now, John and I have a meeting scheduled coming up here with Aubrey from MISO to talk about some other ideas that John has for addressing this need that I think we'll bring back to you if we, after we hear from them. But that's sort of the hard position that I intend to take on cost allocation. I already have in many venues, but moving forward, there's a whole cost allocation team being developed and working on this with OMS in the next 4 months, and that's going to be my position unless you guys have an issue with that. I mean, from what I've heard you say, I think that it's consistent with where we're at in terms of who pays.
I'm not so sure I'm exactly on board. Kind of generally, yeah, but we're in a tough position because in this day and age, everybody loves the government that does things to enhance economic development. That's what people want out there. But people don't understand the electric system. And nobody likes being told they don't understand something either.
Right.
But the reality is we can make the recommendations we want to, but then ultimately it's going to be the RTO that's taking something to FERC, and we don't know how much they're going to really argue for what we had wanted them to be arguing for, and then FERC approving the tariffs. And so while we can say it should be the ones who are going to get the electric service that pay for it, that might not be what FERC does. FERC might say, no, this is something that's going to be paid for by the whole region. And I don't know if you use the same in SPP, region is all of SPP, yeah. Where you have the North region.
Zones.
Zones, yes. When I say region, I'm talking about everybody. Like we will be paying for the transmission line we discussed in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
That's being added because they built a lot of wind and
345 and yeah. And now that's the whole footprint pays for that.
Yeah. And FERC has the ultimate decision, not us. And so while we can argue that, is it going to be heard? To me, the bottom line is we have this responsibility to do our best to understand how this all works and take the right positions on behalf of people who aren't in the room and learning all this stuff and with experts to guide them. And the bottom line is the electric grid ought not be saddled with things that aren't necessary. This is not a sandbox for economic development. This is about providing functions that are going to be used and useful and are needed to provide adequate, reliable, and affordable electric service, not for economic development projects. And so if it's not needed, I really have a hard time supporting it.
Well, and that's, but there again comes the definition of need, you know. If well, there's a market that will pay for it, then, you know, who decides?
But
when is enough? Who's going to make that decision?
The philosophical challenge I have is one, I think government should stay the heck out of energy markets and let free market forces figure it out. But that train has left the station.
Yeah.
So now it's I mean, only, I said this when I was speaking to a group, I said, leave it to government to think that the answer to too much government in the first place is more government. And you say that, of course, people get it. But I'm all for economic development. One of the problems, though, is, and it's a huge problem from North Dakota. We saw it with Stanton. We're potentially seeing it with Coal Creek. And in the name of economic development, we are getting, taking it on the chin in terms of economic destruction. So how do you balance it all out? And, you know, you can look at economic development, okay, but what's the trade-off for North Dakota in particular? And it's a lot. Right now, the potential economic destruction is massive.
Yeah.
And it's on everyone's radar. So how do you balance those? And then the other part is, are we heard? Or is it just, you know, thanks, North Dakota, for weighing in, and MISO's going to march in the direction MISO marches? I wasn't totally sure.
I mean, we can always weigh in.
Yeah.
When they don't, in FERC, too. I mean, we can file with FERC and complain on the tariffs, et cetera. So it's not like we have no voice beyond that, and we can footnote out of things in MISO and, you know. So there are, yeah, but it's an uphill battle because we're different than most places.
Right.
I mean, we're seeing things differently.
Well, and, you know, realistically, when if the tariff for paying for new transmission, if the measure of benefit includes the fact that people get paid for the wind tower sitting on their farmland, et cetera, if that's the benefit, then we should also have included the negative benefit of that wind displacing coal generation that has been our backbone economic development for years and years. And, you know, there's a lot of folks, I don't know if you've talked about it here at the commission, but in other offices here and with our senators as well, they're looking on saving Coal Creek as being the biggest economic development opportunity we have in front of us this year. And I want to tell you another little story that will tie it together with economic development or more with your comments. But in 1972, as a newbie engineer, in August of 72, a group of us went to visit the dispatch center for the utility that we were working for. And we had a great time. The guy that there loved his job, and he loved to tell us about it. And one of the things he pointed out to us is we have this list that's pretty much a secret list, but it exists, of what order we will curtail load if we don't have enough generation. So from 1972 until, I think I'm fair in saying this year, although there were some curtailments last year for different reasons, this year is the first year I know of that the industry has failed to the point where they needed to exercise that list. And you know where that was. And you know the factors that created that environment. So, you know, industry has done a tremendous job for that many years of keeping the lights on for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a pretty significant development in our history.
Well, the thing that it comes down to was, we talked a little bit about this with MISO, is you can solve and prevent that and maintain the reliability by creating a lot more generation and a lot more transmission, or you can change the market rules to keep the resources that we already have viable, or you can do a combination of those things. Now, where I think it's going is very heavily weighted towards the transmission build and new generation. I think that's the answer that all these, because I think a lot of the developers are driving the conversation in all the RTOs. I mean, they just are nationwide controlling the conversation. So that's where I think we have to be, and that's why we're fighting on the side of the tariff reforms too, so that, you know, you have a fairer market that's maintaining the resources that we know can be dispatched.
And when you're right about it's the economic, the new economic development side that is the popular kid in the room, and you know, when there's a project comes out, not only the developing company, but all kinds of politicians will be there to make sure that they get a pat on the back for this new economic development. But when the utility comes in with their request for rate adjustments because of either their direct transmission build-out or just additional costs that the RTOs have accumulated that end up getting passed on to them, there's no way in the world we can deny it. It's a service that they, by law, need to draw a recovery for. But I don't see anybody running up here to help take credit for those increases. You know, then that's where we stand alone.
Mm-hmm. I think the one thing we're doing that I think is on the right track is pushing for that integrated resource planning stuff in the legislative session, because that's where we get the full picture and we can look at more than the, you know, $50 million or $1 billion worth of savings over 30 years, but we can see what are the trade-offs in what you're doing here and over here and how does it relate. And right now we get these things piecemeal and we don't have that. We don't have that vision. And especially for MD or Xcel, because they're largely being pushed by Minnesota and themselves, not even Minnesota. That's their own ambitions.
Yeah. I would agree with that 100%. I think there have been stories written, comments, you know, and those stories about Xcel's doing what they're doing because of Minnesota energy mandates. When I got to the commission, one of the first things I did is I went to the different utility sites. It says right on Xcel site, and it's probably said it for, you know, long before I even got here, 100% renewable or carbon free. I think carbon they might have. Free. I think it said renewable for a while. I think they tweaked it to
carbon free now.
I know it's carbon free now by 2050. I mean, they're not even paying attention to what the Minnesota legislature is requesting from an REO standpoint. They're marching in this direction on their own, and you go to utility after utility across the country, and you're going to see similar. Not all of them in this part of the world, but in other parts, they're all touting that they're going green. But the part they're not telling consumers is how much it's going to cost them in the end,
yeah.
And it's enormous.
Because that's the utility regulator's fault.
Yeah.
Next week, they're in town. I think they're... It's next week. They're meeting with you folks too, I believe. But I do know from some of their other meetings, they're gonna hear a lot about carbon capture and sequestration. And I've gotten some positive feedback from them that fits their carbon free goals. And
yeah.
And they do understand that they need these dispatchable resources, which is encouraging, because some groups you don't get that encouragement that they understand that concept.
You know what would be nice, and you maybe have the credibility to get the point across to them. Well, not maybe. You definitely have more credibility with them, I'd say, than I do. But it's one thing for them to acknowledge it to you or to us. It's another thing for them to go through the kinds of efforts that they make to talk about becoming carbon free. Go through similar efforts to educate their consumers of the need for the dispatchable power. And they make almost zero effort at that.
Yeah, and put their money where their mouth is and agree to a PPA for carbon capture. You know, I think or potentially Colt Creek would, you know, that would help solidify their plans if they knew someone's stepping up to the plate.
Well, I have a 12:30 thing I need to get to, but I do feel like we should keep in touch with John as things evolve and develop on the transmission side of things and on the, yeah, legislatively too, who, you know, during the legislative session, you get called on a lot to talk about issues involving the markets and stuff, and it's, this session won't be any different. I think it'll have intensified, and I think it's important that we try to come out with the right tools, you know, not just feel-good stuff, but yeah, actually meaningful tools and direction from the legislature on this stuff.
Yeah, and I'm trying to promote the idea of let's work together towards a vision. Sorry about that, I meant to turn that off. Let's work together towards a vision that works, recognizing that we do have neighbors that want a different mix of products.
Right.
And I'm fully convinced we can provide that mix of products and do things that are good for North Dakota and avoid giving up our fossil generation. I think there's a place for it. And publicize the good things we're doing. Right now we kind of have a reputation for we want to burn coal and oil and you know, don't care about the environment. But we've done a lot of really great things that fit in with the broader picture, and we do need to publicize that as well.
I think you had brought up, you know, commission position. I don't think you two are that far apart, but in some ways perhaps. But I think that conversation should be continued.
Yeah.
That's.
You know, keep bringing it forward. It would be hard for me to see a viable position that's just, no, we don't want any more transmission. Because, I mean, to me, I don't want to be the one saying, I don't think it's appropriate for us to be the one saying that the wind industry is done. Like, picking them as a loser. And by, if we don't support transmission development, that's what we're doing. And so I'm not willing to go that route. I think it's more important to say, if there's demand for this product elsewhere and people in North Dakota want to have this development here, here's the conditions by which we think we've got to protect our state folks, and that's it.
Well, I think a real simple general statement might be, you know, we want the best of both or all worlds while maintaining low cost and reliable service to our constituents. I mean, that's a lot easier said than done, but, you know, ultimately, if that's the goal, it doesn't inhibit types of development, but it also protects existing resources at the same time.
And we've got parts of the state that look longingly at the wind siting contracts that their neighbors in other parts are getting. You know. We're biased by our physical location, so to speak, because the West has had a lot of opportunity to development.
Our midsection
of the state has not had much.
They said that at the hearing, was it in Ashley or someone said it, you know, we've got ag and we've got ag.
Yeah.
And when ag isn't doing well, our tax base shrinks.
Yeah.
And it impacts schools, emergency services. I mean, that is their mini oil boom, if you will.
Yeah.
So I get it. They're looking for economic development. And if it's all they can get because a manufacturing plant isn't going to be, you know, dropped, are put on the ground down there. Yeah, I can see where you're going to look at it from a different standpoint, but I can also, you know, get up into coal country and it's a different story.
Well, I'm going to ask John my question that I didn't get in yesterday, but I want to point out the dilemma to having people with too much expertise is they talk so long, we don't get a chance to get our questions in either. But the MISO sheets showed several high voltage transmission line plans. Two of them starting in North Dakota and running across Minnesota. The other one was further south. It was at Iowa or wherever, but not involving North Dakota so directly. And now we've been talking about, like, okay, what would we do to add transmission? Years ago, the coal people when they wanted to go from a few old little plants to what we kind of had now for these last few generations, they built some transmission lines. Mm-hmm. We've added 4,000 megawatts of wind. If they want to continue experiment, just build the transmission line.
Yeah.
Because my question for MISO was, though, what makes you think that regardless of the amount of money and who's going to pay for it, that you can build a transmission line, that you're going to get easements and siting approval? Probably wouldn't North Dakota, but across Minnesota. Is there even a possibility of building new ones?
Oh, yes. I'm promoting the idea of private lines, so to speak, as opposed to MISO tariff lines. Mm-hmm. And ELITE, Minnesota Power, has done this, and basically that's what the Coal Creek line has been from day one. And it takes away a lot of the ambiguity of cost allocation, mm-hmm. because it's really based on the idea that I can get somebody to provide electrons to this end of the line, and either the market or that person is going to pay the difference to get it to the other end of the line. And that's.
But could you get that sited across Minnesota anymore?
I think that is a bit of a challenge, but there are a couple options available that you can do without additional siting. One is you can upgrade the DC line from center to Duluth. Another is that you can use the arms on the CapEx 2020 line from Fargo to Monticello.
Well, I think it is high time for NextEra and the other wind developers to step up to the plate and just do that.
I just happen to be meeting with NextEra in 1 hour, and I intend to give them that message. So
we're meeting with MISO on that next week, too, just to talk about what sort of
I was encouraged.
Issues do they have with the operations, or how would it even work? Like, how does that work and tie into the system? So
I was encouraged to see those were DC lines coming out of North Dakota.
Mm-hmm. All right, I have to scoop. John, thank you.
Yep, you're welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot, John.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you.
Anytime.
Sir.
Back here by...